Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm speaking to the deeply impressive Nanjala Nyabola, who's a Kenyan writer, a political analyst and an activist. With degrees from both Oxford University and Harvard Law School, Nanjala's written across a variety of topics, from the internet to politics to travel. Her latest book, Travelling While Black, Essays Inspired by a Life of Travel, looks at the experience of travel through the often overlooked lens of a black female. Nanjala, thanks so much for coming on to speak to us about your really deeply fascinating book and a topic that I think people who don't have first-hand experience of what you write never really think about.
Yes, I wanted to write something that would provoke a little bit of discomfort and provoke a little bit of introspection, because I think we have so many assumptions embedded about in the way we think about human mobility and how people are able to move around the world, and a blind spot really about the complications and challenges that face the vast majority of people in the world. So the book is really not just about traveling like for leisure or on holiday, although there's some of that in there. It's also really just about how people move and how race and gender and other aspects of identity can combine to, you know, deepen inequality and to deepen exclusion and to deepen other forms of structural violence.
And of course, your professional life has been involved very much with refugee and displacement advocacy. So this all feeds into this book of essays.
Yeah, and it's interesting because my interest in refugee protection, migration, comes from being such a traveler and was fueled in part by being able to move around the world as much as I did, as I have. And it, for me, the two have never really been disconnected. It's never really been that I can put one aside and only think about the other. It was a very organic process of seeing the two things side by side and sort of seeing how the complications in one can sort of feed into the complications of the other.
I mean, you make it very, very clear that this is not a travel memoir.
I had to put it in the first sentence, first paragraph multiple times. And it's not, you know, there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with travel memoirs, but I wanted to put, basically what it is I wanted to put a person, a human character, at the center of a conversation about human mobility. And the character, the human character that I knew the best was myself and my own experiences. And the focus really is on putting a human face to some of these conversations. So when people talk about things like, why can't, you know, they look at the channel and they look at the Mediterranean Sea and they say, why can't people just arrive at the airport? Why can't they just go to the airport? And I'm saying, well, this is what going to the airport looks like for someone who on paper is, you know, quote unquote, a good migrant, you know, a good traveler. And it's difficult and it's humiliating and it's complicated and it's, you know, frustrating. Can you imagine what it's like for someone who, you know, doesn't check off the boxes of privilege that we have? And so it's not so much focused on my own, even though there's an element of it in there, my own sort of narrative arc. It's really my place in a broader narrative arc about the state of the world.
I mean, you pose the question, what does it feel like to move through a world designed to limit and exclude you? And as we said at the top, that's not something that would automatically occur to anybody who hadn't been in that situation. Do you find it limiting being this middle-class black woman traveling the world?
In a way, yes, I do. And I want to say, I want to qualify that by saying that I'm very, very much aware that I have it better than millions, if not billions of people around the world. But it is still complicated by the fact that a lot of these things are built into the bureaucracies that govern travel and govern human mobility, and then they tell us that they're neutral. So you think about, for example, and I give this example in the book, Nigerian women to travel to the Middle East requiring letters of permission from their father, requiring letters of permission from, you know, male relatives, you know, going to Thailand and having to prove that you either have a husband or you have another man who can vouch for your quote-unquote character. That's a loaded assumption. That's something that someone is is projecting about what they think, who they think Nigerian women are. And it gets built into, it gets baked into the bureaucracy. And if it's not questioned, then we normalize these kinds of casual exclusions. I talk a lot to European and North American friends, and it's really difficult to convey what it feels like, you know, when you have to go to get a tourist visa, a three-month tourist visa, and you have to prove that you're not a flight risk. So, you know, just to go and apply for that three-month visa, you need a you know, 6 months of bank statements. You need proof that you own a house. You need proof that you have a partner or something like that. Like, the list of requirements keeps getting longer and longer, and the price keeps getting higher and higher. And that's not just a function of efficiency. That's not just a function of we're just building a system. That is a function of policymakers projecting their own assumptions and presumptions about who travelers from different national, racial, ethnic backgrounds are, and trying to codify that into a system. And we have to ask questions about that. And I think the easiest way to push people to ask those questions is to put a human face to it and say, this is what actually this feels like. This is what it looks like.
Now, in the book, you also say that you want to reflect on what it means to be at home and to be unhomed. You say you want to lay bare the dissonance of Africans claiming pan-Africanism whilst embracing xenophobia. And of course, we've seen a great deal of that, particularly in South Africa recently.
You know, that was one of the most difficult sort of sections, passages to put in there, because I have a friend who calls them kitchen conversations. You know, they're conversations that I think Africans need to have with each other. And, you know, you put it in a book and it's going to be read by people who maybe don't necessarily appreciate the historical context. So there was definitely a bit of, do I want to put this in a book? Do I don't want to put it in the book? But I think it's really important. And as you've pointed out, the waves of xenophobia across Africa have risen dramatically in the last 10 years. And I spend a lot of time on South Africa because the violence there has just been growing exponentially. But South Africa is not, by no means, the only country in Africa where we've seen waves of xenophobia. We've seen it in Kenya with the Somali population. We see it in parts of South Sudan. We see it in parts of Tanzania. Like, there is something about the scarcity mindset that the neoliberal state sort of provokes in people that is making people anxious. And I feel like xenophobia is a manifestation of a systemic anxiety about, will there be enough stuff for all of us to have a decent life and to have a peaceful life? And I think that as a person who thinks of themselves as fundamentally Pan-Africanist, I've been really heartbroken by the capture of what is supposed to be discourse on liberation and peace and you know, joy even on the continent, being captured by states as a way of preserving power for certain politicians, you know, longevity in office and things like that. So I settled on leaving the chapter in there, putting the chapter in there, because I think that we need to sit in the discomfort of some of these developments and not, you know, hide from them and run away from them because we want to protect a narrative that is really only serving the functions, serving to protect powerful people. Mm-hmm. We need to just be uncomfortable a little bit. And I hope that that discomfort sort of fuels more productive conversations.
On a purely practical level, I mean, what is it like to travel with guidebooks that are never written with Black women in mind? Because people's reaction to a Black woman travelling alone, for instance, are completely different.
Oh, it can range from the hilarious, the absurd, to downright dangerous and risky. I mean, the hilarious and the absurd is, you know, when people promise you that if you go to the super secret restaurant or hidey hole dive bar and say that you're a foreigner, the doors will open and you will, you know, you might even get a free drink, and you show up and they look at you like, I don't know where you read that, but we don't do that here. It's showing up in hotels in random places in the world. And, you know, the less benign version is showing up in hotels in random places in the world and having people assume that you are there for sex work, and having to navigate that and having to, you know, just because you show up and they have all these pre-existing baggage, you know, they're just like, that's what, you know, we expect from you. I've had awkward conversations with, you know, in Milan, in rural Ghana, in parts of India. There are things that you experience that the guidebook doesn't prepare you for. And if you're not careful, I think I learned very quickly that I have to really lean into the guide part of the guidebook, that it's really just an outline. And you still have to flesh out that outline for yourself, because it can actually be dangerous. Like, it can actually be that, as I say in the book, the world doesn't stop for African women, for Black women who go missing, in the same way that it stops for white women or white men who go missing. So you have to always have that extra layer of calculation and that extra layer of awareness. Awareness, I guess, is the best word that I would put for it.
You ask about what travel can tell us about our sense of self. But of course, all travel for the moment, or most travel for the moment, has ground to a halt. How has COVID impacted on all of this?
I think COVID is forcing us to really reevaluate the structures of travel and the structures of human mobility. One of the things, and again, on different layers, on leisure travel, on business travel, on migration, on, you know, studying and all of these things. So like one of the first things that happened very early on when the European pandemic was intensifying was that the UK government, for example, making it easier for medical professionals from poor countries to emigrate to the United Kingdom. Now, keep in mind that this is the same administration that has tightened restrictions on people arriving by boat in the channel, has created a whole new force, if you will, just for monitoring the channel and you know, running around scaring people in dinghies. And I think that that intellectual tension, that sort of cognitive dissonance, is emblematic of the fact that COVID is begging for us to do things differently. But how many governments are going to have the courage, the moral fortitude to actually do that? Poaching healthcare professionals from poor countries during a moment of vulnerability is not an act of solidarity. It's actually really incredibly selfish. And especially because the reason why you need those healthcare professionals is the systemic underfunding of the public health system that's been happening under the same administration for the previous 4, 5, you know, 10 years. And so we are in a moment of reckoning. And on a less sort of structural level, you know, what's business travel going to look like now that we all have 2-week quarantines to look forward to? You know, I have to be honest, and this is why I say this very early on, I have done one of those absurd, I've done at least a couple of those absurd, you know, I went to San Francisco for 2 days from Nairobi, so I spent more time in the airport, in the air, than I actually did in San Francisco. When now I look back on it, I'm like, that was absurd. Like, whoa, and to give a 2-hour presentation, like that was irrational, but COVID has forced me personally to reflect on the irrationality and the impact that some of those choices are having on the world. And I hope that more people are having that with regards to business travel. And we're going to see a little bit of an easing up on that. But those are just two examples, I think, of the way in which human mobility, travel, migration, and this pandemic moment is a moment of reckoning and a moment of reevaluation.
Mm. Now, the book is about travel, but I'd like to end about asking you about home, because there are so many cliches, aren't there? As an African in exile myself, I'm often asked, well, where is home? And one can say things like, oh, well, it's where the people you love are, or it's the place where you keep your books or whatever. You know, there are endless kind of sappy responses to that. What would be your answer?
I always say home is where my suitcase is. I think that home, for me, my evolving definition is that home is where I can be useful, and home is where I can build, and home is where I can have community. And again, that is a result of having worked in this space and studied this space and experienced human mobility, because I'm loath to bind people to a place when the place where they were born, the accident of birth, subjects them to systemic cruelty and systemic violence. And we still say to them, well, that's your home, you have to go back. So that's why I settled on home really is where a person can be useful and can find joy and can find community.
Nanjala, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Travelling While Black, Essays Inspired by a Life on the Move by Nanjala Nyabola is published by Hearst and Company. And you've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Steph Chungu and Charlie Fulmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.